Composer and bass player Charles Mingus would have been 80 last week. He died in 1979 of the neurological disorder ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Mingus was a composer who could work in extremes. His music was alternately fierce and gorgeous. The moods and time signatures often shifted within a single composition. Since his death, his widow Sue Graham Mingus has devoted much of her life to furthering his legacy. She's the founder and director of the Mingus Big Band, a repertory ensemble devoted to playing Mingus compositions. Now she's written a memoir about her relationship with Mingus called Tonight at Noon. They met in 1964, moved in together in 73, and married in 75. Let's start with a 1959 Mingus recording of his composition, Better Get It in Your Soul. Something about Mingus that seemed to inspire musicians to do their best work when they played with him. Some musicians that sound, you know, okay in other settings sound inspired, fiery when they're playing with Mingus. Is there anything that you can think about that he did on the bandstand or in recording sessions that helped bring out those qualities in the musicians that played with him?
Well, it was two things. It was Charles, but I have to say it was also the music, because we have the same effects now. The musicians will tell you that he is there lashing and whipping them and egging them on from the very center of the music, demanding that they play themselves and that they don't hide and that they bring their own individuality and personality into the center of the music. I say part of this is absolutely a quality of the music itself. The other part was that Charles himself, at the helm, of course, was shouting and screaming and making demands on his musicians here and now on the stage. He would do anything that he needed to do to get the response he wanted. He would curse them, insult them, fire them on stage, hire them back, cajole them, love them, anything that he could do to get that particular quality, that response of the music. He used every method at his command.
In your book, you write that Mingus had said he didn't like pencil composers. He wanted his music to sound like the musicians were making it up as they were playing it. Maybe you could talk a little bit about Mingus's approach to composing.
Well, I have to say up front that Charles never pretended to be consistent, and his views and his method of approaching music changed constantly, as his own approach to life. He once said that he was trying to play the truth of what he was, and the reason that was so difficult is that he was changing all the time. His notions about music changed as well. There was a time when he didn't like pencil composers. He felt that it took away from the immediacy of the music, and he would shout out the lines to the musicians and hum the melodies. But that changed. Of course, Epitaph, his magnum opus, which was a score of 500 pages, it weighed 15 pounds on my bathroom scale. I weighed it one day. I mean, this was all written out. So you see, his approach changed, and what was true one decade was not necessarily true the next decade, or it had expanded and included other approaches to music.
From what I know of Charles Mingus, he seems like he was an exceptionally moody person, swinging back and forth between mania and depression. I don't know whether he was clinically manic depressive or not.
You know, I would not really say that. Certainly, living with Charles at home, he was not moody. He was intense. He was very focused on his music. He spent hours at the piano. It was where he found the center of his being and where he found his peace. He was a very sensitive artist in a society that did not accept who he was, either as an artist or a musician, or as a man with the skin color that wasn't approved. And he fought back. But I don't know that I would talk about mood swings or manic depressive.
He did have one incident in which he was committed. The story is actually part of jazz lore now. Would you tell us your understanding of the Bellevue story?
Bellevue was his own decision. He wanted to get his crazy papers, as he called them. An attorney told him he had signed some kind of contract with a mafia promoter, and he wanted to get out of it. An attorney had told him, if you have crazy papers, you know, you can deny the contract. So he went to Bellevue. He was not taken to Bellevue at all. He went under his own steam, and he talked himself in after hours of talking to the guard. And the guard tried to tell him, you know, this is not a hotel. This is not, because Charles was saying he was an insomniac. He was tired of New York nightlife. He wanted some sleep. Anyway, bottom line, he talked himself into Bellevue and whammo. You know, he barely escaped having a lobotomy. He got out with the help of his friend Nat Hentoff, and he found out it was not a picnic in there. And he wrote a poem called Hell View of Bellevue.
You said that he really did have a nervous breakdown. When did that happen?
He did have a nervous breakdown in the early 70s. Things had been building and building, and the problems of confronting this society and the problems of trying to get his music played. And he came back from a tour and had an episode, as they called it, in Central Park, throwing $100 to the wind and throwing off his clothes. And he was taken to a hospital nearby where he spent 3 months. And then he was released and put on medication and then eventually taken off medication. But that was the only event in the time that I knew Charles where things came to a head, where it actually was a question of going to a hospital and being treated. I think a lot of the things people say about Charles had to do with being a sensitive artist in this society and fighting back with means that were not conventional. Duke Ellington would say, I love you madly. You know, Charles might raise his fist. I mean, you know, people used different methods. Charles was crazy like a fox, I think, and sometimes he carried it to extremes. But I remember one time he said, when Bird was in Birdland and there had been some impossible scene on stage and Monk walked in and they were sitting around backstage talking, he said, I told you guys to act crazy. He said, but I didn't tell you to fall in love with your act. Because, of course, you know, this could be useful. Acting crazy was a way to get attention, a way to get write-ups and so on and so forth.
I want to play a composition that Mingus dedicated to you, and this was recorded in the latter part of the 70s. It's called Sue's Changes. What did he tell you about this piece when he told you about it?
Well, you know, Charles didn't talk about his compositions. Nor did they necessarily reflect their titles. He would sometimes tack on a political title if there was something that moved or disturbed him in the news. And it might be a very lyrical little up-tempo piece, and it might have a title like Remember Rockefeller at Attica during the prison uprising, or Remember Cell Block F, 'Tis Nazi USA. And it might be this kind of lilting little tune that didn't sound like it represented the title at all. And again, there were other political pieces with vocal parts like Fables of Faubus that did indeed reflect a political statement at the time. Sue's Changes, I don't think we talked about. He was actually going to call that Sue's Moods. And because it goes through many different tempo changes and melodies, and I had a newspaper called Changes at the time, and I said, why don't you call it Sue's Changes? So he did, but he would always make a point of saying it had nothing to do with my newspaper.
Well, why don't we hear Sue's Changes? ¶¶ Sue's Changes, recorded in 1974. We'll talk more about Charles Mingus with his widow Sue Graham Mingus after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sue Graham Mingus. Her new book, Tonight at Noon, is a memoir about her relationship with her late husband, the composer and bass player Charles Mingus. Charles Mingus died from Lou Gehrig's disease, ALS. When was he diagnosed, and how did you get the diagnosis?
He had felt that something was wrong. His drummer had pointed out that his fingers weren't as nimble in his bass solos, and he was having trouble with his toes, and he was losing energy. He started sleeping. For someone who wrote a piece called The Man Who Never Sleeps, he started spending most of the days in bed all day long, thinking that that might be the problem. And we went to many specialists around the world, in Milano, in Argentina, and in St. Louis, and finally at the Neurological Center at Columbia Presbyterian, they diagnosed ALS, popularly known as Lou Gehrig's disease. And they said he had 3 months, 3 to 6 months to live, just like that, out of the blue. So, you know, it was a pretty shocking, unexpected, terrible thing. We moved to the building that I'm in now, which is an elevator building, because they told us he would be in a wheelchair very quickly. And we ended up going to Mexico to spend time with witches and healers there, which is where we spent the last 6 months of our life, in a fairly rollicking, vital kind of, considering that Charles was completely paralyzed in a wheelchair, and ordering us all about, and we went out and had feasts at nighttime and traveled up mountains and down valleys and to volcanoes, and with all of Charles's appetites, which never ceased for a moment.
Were you in Mexico hoping to find some kind of, like, miracle cure?
Oh, absolutely. We were down there to beat the rap. We never talked about my carrying on his music, for example. I mean, we were down there running after a miracle.
At what point did he have to stop playing?
Well, he stopped playing at the time that he was diagnosed. We had been out in Arizona, the state where he was born. He played his last concert there in Phoenix. And he barely could walk off the stage, and he got a standing ovation for what turned out to be the last concert in his life. And we canceled the tour then and there, flew back to New York, and went to the hospital, where eventually the physician who had been called in when Bobby Kennedy was shot diagnosed this disease. I told Charles, you know, I was this prestigious physician, et cetera, and he wasn't the least bit impressed. All he said was, Bobby Kennedy died, didn't he? But anyway, it was diagnosed, and then we began the circuit of terminal hope. You know, there are all kinds of the Cobra doctors and the Cobra medicine doctors and the God knows what. You know, you run after every possible hope you can. We went to Switzerland. Charles was shot with these cells of an unborn lamb, which probably has something to it. You know, this is the old wives' tale that if you have treat a sick liver with a healthy liver from an animal, from whatever. And there was a clinic in Switzerland that a lot of famous people, Churchill and Charlie Chaplin and so forth, had gone to. As I said in my book, you know, the famous and the celebrated make the same mistakes the rest of us make. But Charles had all these shots of cells, I think 16 or something, from an unborn lamb. And the next morning he woke up and I looked at him crucified in the bed beside me. You know, the sun was coming over these mountains in Switzerland. And I realized that he was awake and he was staring at me. And I looked at him and all he said was, bah.
Did you have any faith in these experimental cures?
I did, indeed. I think hope is a wondrous thing and you cling to it. And miracles have happened before. The nurses, of course, are the first ones. They're all very upbeat. They all tell you they believe in miracles, and you believe right along with them up until the very end.
At what point did Mingus start to talk about what he wanted for his own death?
Well, I don't know that we ever really talked. His son asked him once what he wanted, and he said, "Do what you." He said, "What kind of funeral do you want?" And Charles said, "Do what you like. I won't be there." But beyond that, he believed in reincarnation. He wanted his ashes scattered in the Ganges River. I think he probably didn't want the gangsters and the promoters and the club owners messing with this passage of his soul from one life to the next. I think he wanted to be on the far side of the globe, away from, he had become disenchanted with jazz funerals where he felt everything was pretty self-promoting and musicians were up there like a gig. And where was the spirit of the person who we were supposed to be remembering? So I think he wanted a very quiet passage into his next life. And I went to India and scattered his ashes in the Ganges, as he had asked. That's how I begin the book.
Where are Charles Mingus's basses now, his instruments?
Well, there's one, the one that that he says plays itself. It has a resonance. If you pluck a string, the sound goes on and on. And our current bass player, Boris Kozlov, is playing that, the Lion's Head bass, in the Mingus Big Band. And there's another bass that he used to bow with. And he carved out one of the shoulders and inverted it because he had a belly and he could lean over more easily to bow. And this is a priceless, this was one of the first basses. It's kind of between the size of a cello and a bass. It's absolutely beautiful looking. This is in my apartment. Another bass I gave to a Hungarian bassist, and he left one to Red Callender, a dear friend of his.
Sue Graham Mingus, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Sue Graham Mingus has written a memoir about her relationship with her late husband, Charles Mingus, called Tonight at Noon. She's the founder and director of the repertory ensemble The Mingus Big Band. We'll close with the title track from their new CD, Tonight at Noon. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurek directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.